New York Society Library. I'm Mark Barber, the head librarian. Thank you for coming out on a cold evening. It's good to see you all here. As we begin, let me ask you to please silence any cell phones, buzzers, ringers, anything that will make any kind of noise during our program. All your neighbors will appreciate it. I wanted to thank all of our library members for their support over the last year. Our annual appeal was quite successful last year, and we're happy to be back in 2014 with another great year of members' room programs, like this evening's, more books being added to our collection, a very busy children's library, and an active community of readers and writers. It's a real honor this evening to introduce Dr. Leo Damrosch. He is Ernest Birnbaum Research Professor of Literature at Harvard University. His biography of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which we have displayed as well, was a National Book Award finalist, and it was also very popular here at the Society Library with our many readers, and is considered one of the definitive biographies of Rousseau. He has now brought the same broad perspective and keen insight into another great mind of the Western canon, Jonathan Swift, in a new book published by Yale University Press last November, Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World. The Boston Globe called this book a magnificent accomplishment, while the New York Times Book Review said it does ample justice to a figure for whom religion and politics, the world, were even more important than literature. Let me also remind you that our friends from the corner bookstore are outside and will be happy to sell you a copy of the book following the event. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Damrosch.
Very kind invitation to speak here tonight. I should explain, research professor is a Harvard euphemism for emeritus. It sounds better. Jonathan Swift is a giant of world literature, but writing was always a sideline for him. He almost never signed his name to anything he published. He was a gifted political writer. He was an able administrator as Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. And after he mobilized Irish resistance to oppression by England, he became a national hero. His lasting literary reputation rests really on two works, but they stand out like peaks and mountains. One is very short and has a long title, A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Poor People in Ireland from Being a Burden to Their Parents or Country and for Making Them Beneficial to the Public by Eating Them, as you probably know. This is quite possibly the greatest single satire in any language. On the other work, of course, is Gulliver's Travels, a great satire that's also a great fantasy novel. Just to confirm that Swift has remained a living voice, here are some fairly recent testimonies. George Orwell said he had read Gulliver's Travels many times and would put it on any list of six books to be preserved when all others were destroyed. Here's an incident that occurred in the Orwellian year, 1984. A Dublin theater had a gala reopening, and they asked the actor Peter O'Toole to speak, and he began reading A Modest Proposal without telling what it was. As he got into details about cooking and eating babies, people began to heckle and walk out on the TV station that went to an ad. And finally, a very recent tribute, the chef Eddie Wong, in his memoir Fresh Off the Boat, says he read A Modest Proposal in college and had a revelation of what really strong writing could do. He said to himself, "Dog, you can win this game." So, Swift is certainly worth knowing about, but telling about him is not so easy. I've read and taught his works for years and years, but it was only when Jennifer Banks, my wonderful editor at Yale University Press, proposed the idea of this biography that it occurred to me to try to do it. It appealed to me, but there are a lot of challenges, and I thought I'd begin by talking about those. He was born in 1667, that's a very long time ago. Puritan rule had ended only 7 years before, when King Charles II recovered his throne. Harvard University, which likes to think of itself as very ancient, was 30 years old at the time. It would be another 60 years before George Washington would be born. So for almost anyone who lived back then, the surviving documents are uneven at best. Swift's letters fill five great big volumes in a modern edition, but 97% of them were written when his life was already half over. So for the earlier and critical phases of his life, there's an awful lot of guesswork involved. I look with enormous admiration and, of course, envy, too, at Robert Caro's awe-inspiring Lyndon Johnson, sustained by massive documentation, but also personal interviews that he conducted with hundreds of people, all of whom had stories they were quite eager to tell. For someone in Swift's era, there's just no equivalent for that. So one has to take a different tack. The historian Ian Mortimer says his books are time travel, in quest of the sensation of being alive in a different time. As it happens, Swift's time was one of revolutionary change. King James II, Charles's younger brother, was kicked out. The modern system of political parties was born. Britain became a world power. Yeats said, with Swift in mind, we should see certain men and women at the edge of a cliff, time broken away from their feet. Well, in the book, I naturally give a lot of space to Swift's writings and also his political and his religious career, but you have to go into a lot of detail to make sense of that, and I don't think I will try to do it in a flyby way tonight. I thought it would be interesting to focus here on a couple of topics. I'll say something about trying to bring that long-ago world back to life, which is the challenge, I think, for any biographer. And then I'll describe the two most important relationships in Swift's life and the detective work that's needed to penetrate his very deliberate wall of secrecy. It's especially worth doing because he's often described very unfairly as a bitter misanthrope. His satires are indignant, all right, but that comes from outrage at how selfish and cruel human beings are. In private life, he was playful and sociable and affectionate. Toward the end, we'll look at a couple of charming poems he wrote for the dear friend known as Stella, and I'll conclude, because his poems aren't as well known as they deserve to be, with some excerpts from a wonderful poem, Imagining What People Will Say About Him After His Own Death, which is full of self-knowledge. So first, some time travel. Swift was born of English parents. He claimed to despise Ireland, but he was very much an Irishman. His birthplace doesn't exist anymore. Neither do any of the other places in Ireland where he lived during a life of 78 years. If you're interested in Samuel Johnson, you can go to Lichfield in England and see his birthplace. In London, you can see the house where he compiled his great dictionary. The Dublin that Swift knew is just gone. But the city he really loved, in fact, was London. And for London, we do have rich contemporary accounts and a lot of pictures, and I'll show you a few. Shakespeare's London, though, was gone. It burned to the ground in the Great Fire of 1666. When Swift got there 25 years later, there was a huge building campaign going on. The modern London was still being created, but open countryside was still extremely close by. Cobblestone streets, very bumpy and jolting to ride in, were full of cows and sheep being driven to market. There were unwieldy freight wagons and hackney coaches clattering along. It was noisy from dawn to dusk. There were nasty smells everywhere, rising especially from the big open sewer known as Fleet Ditch, which is now covered over and runs under Fleet Street. People emptied their chambers pots right into the street. There's a recent book that provides a needed breath of bad air. Its title is Hubbub, Filth, Noise, and Stench in England, 1600 to 1770. Swift was hypersensitive to bad smells and noise, and he often mentions them. The diarist Samuel Pepys, a generation earlier, is a very engaging guide to London life, pleasant and unpleasant. Here's his memorable account of a jolting carriage ride. I came home in pain from riding a little uneasily tonight for my testicles. On another occasion, he said, I went down in the cellar and put my foot into a great heap of turds, by which I find Mr. Turner's house of office has overflowed into my cellar, which doth trouble me. Something else from Pepys's life helps us realize how long ago this was. He went to St. Paul's School, one of the best in England, then he went to Cambridge University. But when he became a civil servant, he hired a tutor to teach him the multiplication table. Remember Alice saying, what's the use of a book without pictures or conversations? Well, a number of engaging conversations did get recorded by Swift's friends, and those are in my book, of course. As for pictures, it's possible to open a window into his world, and I took some pains finding pictures for this book. Portraits of people, of course. I prefer engravings to reproductions of oil paintings, because in small black and white versions, they don't look very impressive. What did Swift himself look like? He was jowly and overweight. If we could have the first picture, Sarah, thanks.
Nope, so put that on.
He said himself his looks were not prepossessing. The most notable feature was compellingly bright blue eyes, but those don't show up well even in colored portraits. Here he is in 1710, in his early 40s. It's the first picture of him we have. We were going to have a different cover picture, but the marketing people at Yale said it has to be a portrait or it doesn't look like a biography. So the designer did it very best to temper the stolidness of this image with that flowing signature. He's dressed in his clerical gown. Those white tags at his neck are clergyman's bands, which were like a priest's collar today. As for the eyes, which indeed don't show up too well, his friend, the poet Alexander Pope, said, "They are as azure as the heavens, and there's a very uncommon archness in them." We have one informal sketch, which I ought to be advancing to. I tried this before, and it worked like a charm. Okay, thank you. He's wearing a cap indoors because before central heat, you need one to keep warm. The solemn expression was said to be characteristic. He was not only witty, but he had a wonderful sense of humor, which are two things that don't always go together. Voltaire had wit, but not humor. Dickens had humor, but not wit. Swift had both, like Mark Twain, and he resembled Twain in keeping a deadpan expression when everybody else was cracking up. He resembled Twain also in giving expression to bitterness that was really disappointed idealism, disgust at how badly we fall short of what we ought to be. He could have easily said, as Twain did say, "Let a man be black or white, Christian, Jew, or Muslim, it's all the same to me. All I have to know is he's a human being. He couldn't be worse." There we go, sorry. This is 25 years later. Swift has aged a great deal. He's a famous writer by now, so there's a statue of Apollo with a lyre in the background. But his health is failing, he's nearly deaf, he's painfully aware of short-term memory loss, which came on when he was still relatively young, presaging the dementia that would indeed make him totally helpless for the last 4 years of his life. More than once when he was walking or riding with friends, he would point to a tree and say, "I should be like that tree, dead at the top first." In Gulliver's Travels, Swift imagined a land in which infants are occasionally born with a mark on their forehead that indicates they will never die. How wonderful, Gulliver cries. But of course, he assumes they'll enjoy eternal youth. On the contrary, they get old just like everyone else, and what they experience then is eternal senility. The Victorian illustrator Arthur Rackham captured superbly the menace that haunted Swift, to which he did eventually succumb. Deterioration is all too apparent in this last portrait we have, painted a few years later. The last portrait, but not the last image, for in 1835, 90 years after Swift was buried in St. Patrick's Cathedral, an underground river flooded the cathedral, and it had to be repaired, and his grave under the floor was dug up. It was the heyday of phrenology. Believe it or not, Swift's skull was handed about in the Dublin Learned Societies before they reinterred it for good. The phrenologists concluded absurdly that the organ of wit was underdeveloped. This picture was made, incidentally, for a 19th century book about Swift by a distinguished Dublin surgeon, Sir William Wilde. Sir William would have been very surprised to learn that if posterity remembered him at all, it was as the father of Oscar Wilde. That's pretty much all we have when we try to visualize Jonathan Swift. It doesn't help, of course, that he's usually shown wearing a big generic wig, all gentlemen did, which makes them hard to tell apart. Wigs in wigs, somebody said. Swift was himself first a Whig and later a Tory. Still, a good portrait can give a sense of individuality. This forbidding character is Lord Godolphin, who was Lord Treasurer, what we would call Prime Minister, at a crucial time in Swift's career. He's holding the narrow white staff that was the Lord Treasurer's emblem of office, and on his shoulder you see the badge of the high distinction of the Order of the Garter with its motto, "Omni soi qui mal y pense." Godolphin is one of those dusty old names that blur together when you read about them, but as you can see, he was a hard-bitten, ruthless individual and very intimidating indeed. Who's the leading poet and playwright of the day? A distant relative of Swift's named John Dryden. In his youth, Swift had some notion of becoming a serious poet himself, and he brought his efforts to show Dryden. In truth, those early poems were pretty bad, and Dryden said so. "Cousin Swift," he said, "you will never be a poet." The portrait captures Dryden's maddening air of cool superiority, looking down his long nose at us. Actually, as I said, Swift became a very good poet, but in a totally different style. After William and Mary came to the throne, Swift got to know them personally because he was working as secretary to a retired diplomat who was a close friend of theirs, Sir William Temple, his name was. These monarchs, too, I think, have left an indistinct image in our consciousness, but they were striking individuals in their own right. King William III, formerly Prince of Orange in Holland, an able warrior and administrator, highly intelligent, the historian Macaulay describes his thoughtful and somewhat sullen brow, firm and somewhat peevish mouth, cheek pale and thin, deeply furrowed by sickness and care. To stroll in Sir William's garden with this formidable monarch was a memorable experience for the young Swift. As for Queen Mary, in later life, she acquired a rather stodgy image, so I thought I would represent her as she looked when she was still a young princess. As I comment in my caption, she has the sultry expression and encouraging breasts of a Restoration court lady. One place Swift lived that can still be visited is in England, the country house where Sir William Temple, his employer, resided, 40 miles west of London, near Farnham in Surrey. The house was known as Moor Park. You can see the formal gardens in which Sir William delighted to grow fruit, and the river to the left, which he had diverted into an ornamental canal. Far left is the very bottom of a hill that Swift used to run up and down whenever he took a break from work. He suffered all his life from a debilitating condition that brought on nausea and incapacitating vertigo. It's now known to be Meniere's syndrome or disease, disorder of the inner ear, but at the time there was no possible way to diagnose it. Interestingly, his doctors always begged him to stop. They believed firmly that exercise was very bad for you. This is Moor Park today, or well, maybe we are. Though the facade has totally changed, you saw it was brick back then. That huge cedar tree gives you an idea of just how long ago it was. That was planted after Swift lived there. It wasn't in the other picture. When I was taking this picture, one of the residents of the house came down to chat with me, and he said that that bit of water in the foreground is the last vestige of Sir William's canal. Sir William Temple was an essayist of some merit. He thought he was a world-class writer. So the reason he hired Swift was as a stenographer to take dictation and get his papers in order for publication. And this is a typical page of Swift's secretarial work in his careful handwriting. It's always exciting to hold an actual document like this. Sir William has gone over it, and you see that's his writing there, written in a correction or two. It never crossed his mind that his young employee, and not himself, was destined to be one of the great writers of the world. In the robust words of Macaulay, little did Temple imagine that his dependent had a genius equally suited to politics and to letters, a genius destined to shake great kingdoms, to stir the laughter and the rage of millions, and to leave to posterity memorials which can perish only with the English language. Here's another example of Swift's handwriting. It's from letters he wrote to his closest friend, that are known today as the Journal to Stella, and I'll come back to that later. This letter begins with a bit of playful rhyming. "This is a pitiful letter, for want of a better, but played with a tetter, my fancy does better." A tetter was an outbreak of herpes. This is a letter to Swift from a young woman he called Vanessa, with whom he had a strong but deeply troubled relationship, and I'll talk about that too. The writing is messy because it's her draft of the letter she actually sent. Maybe you can make out what she says just below the middle of the page. "Oh that I could hope to see you here, or that I could go to you. I was born with violent passions which terminate all in one, the inexpressible passion I have for you. Consider the killing emotions which I feel for your neglect of me, and show some tenderness, or I shall lose my senses." It's very moving to sit in the comfortable reading room of the British Library and read this kind of heartfelt appeal in Vanessa's actual handwriting. Come back to her too. I mentioned the London Swift knew was very different from the London of today. Here's a familiar icon. If you know London, these tube stations are familiar. Earl's Court, Kensington, Knightsbridge, Paddington, Marylebone, Tottenham Court. This is London in 1695. Swift was living at Moor Park, 40 miles away, but often went into London. Every one of the places I mentioned is here as a little rural village. There's Paddington, Marylebone, Tottenham Court. Those tube stops are just hamlets out in the fields. Even within the city limits, the London we know was just coming into being. This also is 1695, not very impressive, is it? Until you notice the caption. This is Sir Christopher Wren's St. Paul's Cathedral, with the iconic dome yet to come. Here's a map from 25 years later, cropped it to show central London in 1720. The street plan is the same as today. Covent Garden is up there, though it doesn't have the arcades that went up in the 19th century. Scotland Yard is there, Charing Cross is there, all of that is the same. St. Martin's in the Fields, certainly familiar to many of you. What is the Great Mews? That was an extensive stable area, which is now Trafalgar Square and the National Gallery. So it's once the London we know and not our London at all. Let's go back to Dublin. Swift graduated from Trinity College. Without much distinction, the curriculum was extremely old-fashioned and boring, and he didn't try very hard. This map was made not long after his death. There's the college up there, or of course it still is, but not one single building survives that Swift would have seen. St. Stephen's Green was just beginning to get its townhouses, Georgian townhouses around it, which are now such a distinctive jewel of Dublin. But just below there, it's open countryside all around. These were still small and quite rustic cities. What he would still recognize is the broad, sandy beaches east of Dublin. He loved to ride on horseback, one reason, no doubt, that intelligent horses play a role in Gulliver's travels. This is the picture we were going to use for the cover. But somebody had the inspiration of creating a accurate to scale effigy of Captain Lemuel Gulliver, 12 times bigger than ourselves, and have him lie on a beach that Swift knew perfectly well. There are even people on horseback looking on in amazement, though the automobiles would certainly have puzzled him. There's St. Patrick's Cathedral, and that, of course, has not changed. It looks just as it was when he was there. But I found this interesting. It's a movable pulpit that Swift actually had made. It has little wheels underneath it. He took his duty as a preacher very seriously, and he didn't want to be remote from the congregation in a big stone pulpit halfway up the wall. Cathedral has a few artifacts from his life. This pincer-like device is a holder that he actually owned for a rushlight. Wax candles were very expensive, and he was kind of stingy, so he would get by with the flickering light of rushes dipped in animal fat. They were smoky and they were smelly, but they were cheap. He did love wine, and he imported big barrels full of it from France, and then would decant it as needed into these green glass bottles, roughly the same capacity as our wine bottles. Somebody in the 19th century made this drawing. As you see, they have his personal seal on them. The most affecting thing in the cathedral is a modest wall plaque that he had mounted among the tributes to the rich and famous. Alexander McGee, who was known as Saunders, was Swift's faithful manservant. He wrote to a friend, "Poor Saunders died on Saturday last and was buried on Easter Sunday. In him I have lost one of my best friends as well as the best servant in the kingdom." Swift shed tears at the funeral, and he rather shocked his snobbish friends by putting up this memorial. "Here lies the body of Alexander McGee, servant to Dr. Swift, Dean of St. Patrick's. His grateful master caused this monument to be erected in memory of his discretion, fidelity, and diligence in that humble station." And one last picture. Just inside the main doorway, you will find this pair of brass plaques set into the floor. They testify that buried beneath are Jonathan Swift, Dean, and on the right, Esther Johnson, parenthesis, Stella. Sarah, that's the pictures. Who was Esther Johnson or Stella? After Swift finished college, he got that job as secretary to Sir William Temple at Moor Park. And in that household was a bright 9-year-old girl, the housekeeper's daughter, who was being trained as a servant herself. That was Esther Johnson. It is surely remarkable that Temple arranged to have his servant's child tutored by Swift, and more remarkable that when he died 10 years later, he left her a bequest worth £1,000, where the other servants got 10 or 20 pounds each. She remained Swift's closest friend for the rest of her life. She died, unfortunately, quite young. When he moved to Dublin, she moved there to be close to him. When he was working in politics in London, however, he sent her those letters that we call the Journal to Stella. When they were together in Dublin, though they saw each other pretty much every day, apparently they were never alone without a third party. Nonetheless, some of their best friends, I mean really close friends, were convinced they were secretly married. Well, if they were married, why did it have to be secret? And there's no question that Swift wanted whatever it was to be a secret. Well, there were widespread rumors in their own lifetimes that Stella was the illegitimate daughter of Sir William Temple. That would certainly explain why he treated her so well and left her a big bequest. But biographers who used to be very positivist about anything they can't prove with documents, as I began by saying, that rules out nearly everything from that period, they would dismiss these rumors as mere hearsay and gossip. Irvin Aaron Price, who was my colleague for 15 years at the University of Virginia, a very distinguished Swift scholar and author of the 2,000-page, three-volume biography of Swift, just pretty much ignores those rumors as irrelevant. But a remarkable piece of evidence has been available in print ever since 1757, which Aaron Price was well aware of, but understandably ignored, because it was published in a magazine anonymously more than 50 years after this period that we're thinking about, so it naturally looked like the nearest gossip. But some years ago, somebody at the University of Tulsa, who unluckily published his findings in a very obscure Tulsa publication, so they didn't get much notice, did some brilliant detective work and figured out this guy in 1757 knew a number of facts that had never yet been in print. He evidently must have been at Moor Park when people were there. Well, that narrows down the range of possible people. It must be a man in his 80s who had lived at Moor Park, and he existed. His name was the Reverend John Jerry. His father was the vicar of a nearby parish. And he did indeed live in that household, and he did indeed have personal memories of everybody there. He begins his letter to the magazine, Gentleman's Magazine, it was called. It was like the Reader's Digest at the time, very widely read, by describing Stella's mother, Bridget Johnson. She was the widow of a merchant and came to Moor Park, he says, in the character of a housekeeper. And this is the only description we have of Bridget Johnson, so I'm the first biographer who ever quoted it. She was a person of surprising genius. Few women ever exceeded her in the extent of her reading, none in the charms of conversation. She had seen the world. Whoever had the pleasure of conversing with her for a quarter of an hour was convinced she had known a more genteel walk in her life than her present situation. She had fine features, an excellent complexion, animated by eyes that perfectly described the brightness of her genius. So the Reverend Jerry thought it was perfectly obvious that Bridget Johnson had been Temple's mistress, and that Stella was their daughter. He added that Stella looked exactly like Sir William Temple and had the same jet black hair. I can't show you a picture of Esther herself, alas, whom we call Stella because Swift eventually gave her that nickname, because there is no authentic one. Every biographer will give you a picture of somebody called Stella, but they're all different women. And obviously, various families have liked to think that they owned a picture of Stella without being able to prove it, so I left it out. Okay, this explains why Temple took such pains over Stella's livelihood. Aaron Price, whose ideas were formed way back in the 1940s, I think was just too shocked by the idea of illegitimacy to even give it a hearing. A lot of other things he was unwilling to think about. He never mentions the story about pointing to the tree and saying, "I shall be like that tree dead at the top first," although at least two different friends of Swift reported it on different occasions, and I'm sure he said it often. Now, what about that alleged marriage? Swift was deeply fond of Stella from the time he met her as a young child. It wasn't a Lewis Carroll. Somebody said Carroll only had two interests in life, which were formal logic and little girls, and he put them both in the same book. Now, here's a thought-provoking hypothesis that was advanced by two Dublin independent researchers. And I stress that because academic Swiftians for a long time really did circle the wagons. And if you weren't on the team, you weren't worth listening to. But these were gifted researchers and very scrupulous with evidence. And one thing they turned up is how hard it is to prove that Swift was actually the son of the young lawyer Jonathan Swift Sr., who died some months before he was born, just in time, he would say, to save my mother's reputation. But it's not clear exactly how long before he was born that Jonathan Swift did die. And it's quite possible that his father was actually a different Temple, Sir John Temple, the father of Sir William, who was in his 50s at the time and was very active in Dublin legal circles. And the elder Jonathan Swift and his three brothers were all Dublin lawyers. And Jonathan Swift, the elder, suddenly got a plum job at the Inns of Court and suddenly became a barrister, which he'd been trying for years to be, inexplicably, unless there was some kind of arrangement going on. So here's the hypothesis. If Jonathan Swift's mother was mistress of Sir John Temple, and there's some circumstantial evidence to suggest she might have been, then it would have been useful to provide her with a suitable husband. And this is what may have happened. And this is all guesswork, but why not? I mean, the story, which I won't now labor through, about Swift's early life is so far-fetched and weird that almost anything would be more plausible than that. It has to do with his wet nurse stealing him away unexpectedly to England for 3 years and nobody going to fetch him back. And when he's finally returned to Dublin, his mother goes to England forever and he never sees her again until he's 21. So you can believe that story if you want.
Yes.
And he may have believed it because it's a story he was told, but it's full of holes, as it would be easy to show you if we kept exploring it. So the hypothesis is, at some point, Swift and Stella discovered to their horror that they were blood relatives, that he was the half-brother of her father and therefore her uncle. And if indeed they had become secretly married, this was now against the law as well as, of course, against religious regulations. And so it would have been necessary to keep it as secret as possible and to be close friends, but nothing more than that. That's a guess. It's a possibility. At any rate, it was the most important relationship of Swift's life. And as I mentioned, during the 3 years that he was working in London politics, he was sending a letter. He would write it every evening and every couple of weeks put a packet of it together and send it back to Dublin, which are now known as the Journal to Stella. And in reading those wonderful letters, we can hear Swift's authentic voice, informal, playful, unfortunately not Stella's voice because her letters are gone. Here's an example. I dined today with Patty Rolton, my cousin Leeches with a pox. He's a printer and prints the postman, oh ho, and he's my cousin, God knows how, and he married Mrs. Baby Ayers of Leicester, and my cousin Leech offers to bring me acquainted with the author of the postman and says the gentleman will be glad of my acquaintance and is a very ingenious man and a great scholar and has been beyond the sea. But I was modest and said maybe the gentleman was shy and not fond of new acquaintance, and so I put it off. I wish you could hear me repeating this in its proper tone, just as I'm writing it. It is all the same as ooh-hoo, or when little girls say, I've got an apple, miss, and I won't give you some. As for Mrs. Baby Ayers, Sir Harold Williams explains in his edition of the journal, she may be fictitious. One can imagine what Swift would have said about Sir Harold. There are passages in the journal that can only be called baby talk. Their name for it was Ourritcher Gangridge, meaning our little language. Many readers have found it embarrassing and cloying, but it does anyway indicate a special intimacy. There are frequent glimpses of street life. The night watchman's call, past 12 o'clock, spelled in that drawn-out way. Or treats for sale on the 12th day of Christmas. Swift writes, silly, silly, every kind of thing is silly. As I walked into the city, I was stopped with clusters of boys and wenches buzzing about the cake shop like flies. The changing seasons are noted. The canal in the park is full of people sliding with skates, if you know what those are. They were a novelty recently brought from Holland. Sometimes an element of strangeness enters the journal when Swift reports his dreams. Lord, I dreamt of Stella so confusedly last night. Then we saw Dean Bolton and Dean Stern go into a shop, and then they proved to be two parsons I know not. And I walked outside till she was shifting and such stuff, mixed with much melancholy and uneasiness and things not as they should be, and I know not how. It's a gloomy, ugly morning. This is what Freud calls the uncanny, familiar things turning disconcertingly strange. This dissolving dream world has a lot in common with the disorienting changes in Gulliver's travels. By shifting, he means Stella was changing her clothes inside the shop. Why does he wait till then to go inside? Is he watching her? There's often talk about the physical reality of her letters, anticipating them, opening them, reacting to them. Swift sometimes narrates the process moment by moment in a sort of flirty foreplay. During the cold London winters, he spent a lot of time reading and writing in bed, and Stella's letters join him there. I've now gone into bed and going to open your little letter. God send I may find you well and happy and merry. Oh, I won't open it yet. Yes, I will. No, I won't. My fingers itch. Now I have it in my left hand. Now I'll open it this very moment. I've just got it, and I can't imagine what's in it. Another time, let's come and see what this saucy dear letter says. Come out, letter. Come from between the sheets. Here it is underneath, and it won't come out. Come out again. Here it is. There's a startling moment when Swift imagines Stella getting up in Dublin, just as he is in London. She is just now showing a white leg and putting it into the slipper. Could this have some relation to another odd dream he had described earlier? In that dream, he imagined a mysterious saying was circulating in town. I have desired Apronia to be always careful, especially about the legs. Stella had written to Swift to ask to buy an apron for her. So is Apronia the apron with the legs underneath it? 3 days before this, he actually made, which was rare for him, an overt double entendre. It's terribly cold. I wish my cold hand was in the warmest place about you. Detailed and confiding, as the journalist Stella obviously is, there is one remarkable omission. Not once does Swift mention a different Esther, Esther Van Humbry, a Dutch name, a young woman with whom he had begun to spend a great deal of time. We know this Esther, too, by a name Swift gave her in a long poem about their relationship. She's the one called Vanessa. When they met, he was 42. She was a brilliant and beautiful girl of 19. She fell desperately in love with him and believed, or at least she hoped, that he intended to marry her, but that never happened. During his years in London, he saw her constantly. Stella, back in Dublin, expected something was going on, but he covered it up carefully. Louise Bogan wrote a crisply skeptical poem called Hypocrite Swift. It ends like this. Hypocrite Swift sent Stella a green apron and dead desire. In 1714, 5 years after Swift and Vanessa met, the fall of the Tory government that he was working for ended his political career, and he returned to Dublin for good as Dean of St. Patrick's. By then, Vanessa's parents had died, and she inherited a considerable sum of money. She promptly followed Swift to Dublin and settled down in a big house 10 miles outside town with a townhouse in the city. They sometimes met as frequently as once a week in complete secrecy. The rest of the time, they communicated by letter. Swift's letters have all vanished. Undoubtedly, he expected Vanessa's to vanish, too. But as we saw, she saved her drafts. And at her premature death from tuberculosis, 9 years after she got to Ireland, she left instructions to have them published. Her executors, however, were concerned to preserve Swift's reputation, and it's clear that they destroyed half of them, and she numbered the letters. The ones that survived, though, show how passionately she loved him and how hard to get he continued to be. She was sometimes near despair. I am sure I could have borne the rack better than those killing, killing words of yours. At other times, though, he did reply in the way she wanted. Be assured, he declared, writing in French for greater privacy, no one on earth has ever been loved, honored, esteemed, adored by your friend but yourself. Whenever he wrote like that, she would be joyful. You are good beyond expression. I will never quarrel again if I can help it. In the letters, they had a private code. Swift suggested, a stroke thus, dash, 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 signifies everything that may be said. In her letters from then on, the dashes flew thick and fast. I have worn out my days in sighing and my nights with watching and thinking of dash, 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 dash. Only they knew what words were meant. Frequently, the word coffee was part of the same code, and it always has a suggestive aura. Swift writes, I wish I were to walk with you 50 times about your garden and then drink your coffee. I drank no coffee since I left you, nor intend to until I see you again. There is none worth drinking but yours. Without health, you will lose all desire of drinking your coffee. At one point, the absence of Vanessa's coffee is so disturbing it interferes with Swift's work as a writer. I'm not cheerful enough to write, for I believe coffee once a week is necessary to do that. It's hard to believe this refers to a beverage. The book which Swift was trying to write at that time was Gulliver's Travels. Most of his biographers from our time, his time to ours, have been strangely judgmental about this relationship. Aaron Price quotes the phrase about killing, killing words, and then he puts Vanessa in her place. Quoting Aaron Price, drawing on a well-stocked arsenal of emotional blackmail, she enjoyed the thrill of humiliating herself before the father lover who remained deliciously out of reach. The index to Aaron Price's book cites this passage under two different headings, emotional extortion and masochism. His take, and he admits he doesn't even quote most of the letters because he says they would give you the wrong impression, his take is she was a neurotic bitch who was harassing a kind older gentleman who was trying to let her down gently. This is, you know, cruelly wrong. It's amazing how insensitive biographers have been to her suffering. She was in love. She was willing to wait and hope. One of Swift's younger relatives, I think, was most accurate. He said, she was worthy of a happier fate, a martyr to love and constancy. Here's the very last letter of Vanessa's that we have. She says, all other disappointments in life I can bear with ease, but that of being neglected by dash, dash, dash. You have often told me the best maxim in life is to seize the moments as they fly, but these happy moments always fly out of the reach of the unfortunate. One of William Blake's great lyrics in its entirety reads like this, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Vanessa could never stop trying to bind the joy, even when her heart was breaking and her health was giving out. There was an understandable breach between Swift and Stella at this time, but after Vanessa's death, they were reconciled. Unfortunately, Stella, too, fell ill, very likely with tuberculosis also. She died at the age of 39 in 1728. 5 years after Vanessa did. Swift had known her for 40 years, and for the past 27, apart from those stays in England, they saw each other, as I say, almost every day. Well, we'll never know exactly what their relationship was. How could we? Their best friends didn't know. But the depth of affection is obvious, and the playful wit that they shared. Here's some lines from one of those birthday poems that Swift wrote every year for Stella. No poet ever sweetly sung, unless he were like Phoebus young. Nor ever nymph inspired to rhyme, unless like Venus in her prime. At 56, if this be true, am I a poet fit for you? Or at the age of 43, are you a subject fit for me? Adieu, bright wit and radiant eyes, you must be grave and I be wise. Our fate in vain we would oppose, and I'll be still your friend in prose. He's actually a wonderful poet in this informal, colloquial, easygoing style. Perhaps the best clue to the relationship is something Swift said after Stella was gone. Violent friendship is much more lasting and as much engaging as violent love. As he made all too clear to Vanessa, he was skeptical of the swept away kind of falling in love. He may well have feared it. He said much the same thing in one of the Stella poems. Without one word of Cupid's darts, of killing eyes or bleeding hearts, with friendship and esteem possessed, I ne'er admitted love a guest. But if the friendship was truly violent, most people would call it love. I hope it's apparent from these effortlessly colloquial verses that Dryden was wrong. Cousin Swift became a very accomplished poet. And the best of all his poems, as I mentioned at the beginning, is the anticipation of what they'll say about him when he's dead. It's called Verses on the Death of Dr. Swift, Doctor of Theology. It's full of rueful self-knowledge. And I thought I'd close with that to honor Swift the writer. The time is not remote when I must by the course of nature die. There's a potent rhyme for you, the first person pronoun. When I foresee my special friends will try to find their private ends, though it is hardly understood which way my death can do them good. Yet thus methinks I hear them speak, see how the dean begins to break. Poor gentleman, he droops apace, you plainly find it in his face. That old vertigo in his head will never leave him till he's dead. Besides, his memory decays. He recollects not what he says. Cannot call his friends to mind. Forgets the place where last he dined. Plies he with stories o'er and o'er. He told them 50 times before. How does he fancy we can sit to hear his out-of-fashion wit? But he takes up with younger folks, who, for his wine, will bear his jokes. It's a painful self-knowledge, isn't it? He saw his face decaying, and know about the memory. Then he imagines the ladies at the card table. My female friends, whose tender hearts, had better learn to act their parts, receive the news in doleful dumps. The dean is dead. What is trumps? 16s, they say, must bear the pall. I wish I knew what came to call. Madam, your husband will attend the funeral of so good a friend. No, madam, 'tis a shocking sight, and he's engaged tomorrow night. He loved the dean, I lead a heart. His dearest friends, they say, must part. His time was come, he ran his race. We hope he's in a better place. I lead a heart indeed. They hope he's in a better place, but they're not too confident about it. At the end of this long poem, however, Swift allows himself a wholehearted tribute, which he puts in the mouth of an impartial witness. The dean, if we believe report, was never ill-received at court. As for his works, in verse and prose, I don't myself no judge of those, nor can I tell what critics thought him. But this I know, people bought him. As with a moral view designed to cure the vices of mankind, his vein, ironically grave, exposed the fool and lashed the knave. To steal a hint was never known, but what he writ was all his own. And indeed, he's one of the most original writers who ever lived, and yet that's a typical piece of Swiftian wit. He says, what he writ was all his own, and he has lifted that line verbatim from a previous poet. Well, as I mentioned at the start, it wasn't as a writer that Swift most valued his achievement. It was as an Irish patriot that he wanted to be remembered, and historians tell us he was one of the very first to begin creating a national consciousness for Ireland. He was a member of the minority, not just Protestant, but Anglican ascendancy that governed Ireland. He had no patience with the Presbyterians, even though they were Protestants, and although sympathetic to the sufferings of the Catholic majority, pretty remote from them. But in fact, and this isn't the time to describe the whole episode, he began to give the people of Ireland a sense we are a people, we are a nation, we're being treated like an exploited colony like Jamaica when we ought to be part of the kingdom itself. Every year on his birthday, there would be bonfires and church bells ringing, and he would be celebrated as a kind of an oracle. So he's quite right to end with that. And here's some noble lines from the verses on the death of Dr. Swift. He's recalling a time when there was indeed a price on his head for writing pamphlets that were offensive to the government. Fair liberty was all his cry. For her he stood prepared to die. For her he boldly stood alone. For her he oft exposed his own. And I'll close with an anecdote that dates from the 1960s. A science writer read Gulliver's Travels and pretended, no doubt tongue-in-cheek, to believe that it was a recent publication, and wrote to the Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, addressing him as Jonathan Swift, for permission to quote from it. So the then Dean sent this courteous reply. Dr. Swift departed from here on 19th October, 1745. He left no forwarding address. Since that date, as far as I know, he has not communicated with friend or foe. Where he is at present, God only knows. Thank you very much.
And usually if it's a painting, you see drafts of it, some indication of where it comes from. But in your wonderful book, I didn't see any cartoons of Gulliver, any drafts of it, anything like that. I also wanted to make it a double-barrel question. I wonder how your able students have reacted to Gulliver when you teach it.
Yes.
Two different questions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did Hillary come from, and how did students react to it?
Yeah.
Take the second one first. I mean, it really survives as living literature. It's something. Where it came from, let's put it this way. He didn't leave drafts. He didn't like to keep his papers. But he loved reading travel books. It was a kind of almost passion with him. But he was always suspicious of truth stranger than fiction stories. And I think was particularly contemptuous of Robinson Crusoe, which pretends to be the voracious tale of a guy who spent 28 years on a desert island, and instead of going completely crazy, found God and came back richer than before. So partly it's a parody of that kind of pseudo-voracious travel writing. But also, I think it began as a satire. It was supposed to be about Sir Robert Walpole, the Prime Minister, and there's a lot of coded stuff in there, but fortunately for us, to avoid prosecution, he had to make it very indirect. So instead of being a, you know, spot-on satire that would now bore us to tears, it's about how human beings behave in all times and places. But the other thing, which is really my answer and why students still love it, is the element of fantasy is obviously an end in itself. Literary critics always say it's not a novel because this is a mouthpiece for a satire. Of course it's a novel. The idea of being tied down by the tiny people, you know, although it's a kind of allegory of Swiss career, you know, it's about always having to do it all his life, is just sort of physically potent to read about, and the flying island and the talking horses, yeah. So, yeah, and he knew it was a great book, but he spent 4 years working on it. He realized he found something here.
How did being an Irish nationalist fit in with being a Tory?
Well, Whigs and Tories, it's not like Tories were conservative and Whigs were liberal. They were all conservative.
I mean, I was thinking of John Churchill, for instance, being maybe your quintessential Whig.
How do you mean?
Sort of internationalist.
He was a reluctant Irishman. He said it was the land of Finns and slaves. But by slaves, he meant they're complicit in their own oppression because they, you know, allow the English to force them to buy English goods and not sell their own goods and so on. But I think it was a genuine sense of the land. He traveled all the time. He saw the appalling poverty of the cottagers in the countryside. He could see it was the landlords squeezing them that made that happen. He was actually impressed by the intelligence and wit of ordinary Irish people. So I think in spite of himself, he became Irish, and it's partly because his career as an Englishman was so thwarted, and he should have been a bishop in the Church of England, and they made sure he never was. I think he identified with an oppressed people and acted out his own resentments through them. I don't know if that answers your question.
How old was Stella when she received those playful letters?
She'd been in her 30s. Her late 20s and 30s, yeah. Yes, Clark?
His sermons. Was his wit evident in his
no.
sermons?
No. He took preaching seriously, but he had no use for theology. seriously, I mean, he thought the Trinity, whatever that is totally inexplicable. It's a mystery. We're supposed to believe it. He actually said in his private notes, "I can't be reproached by the Almighty for not believing something I just can't make myself believe, as long as I never tell anyone about it." But, you know, so the sermons are just four square advice on how to lead a moral life. And he took pains over them. He wanted them to be very easy to understand. A lot of preachers put Latin in and so on. He wouldn't do that. But he didn't have any interest in them. He destroyed most of them. The only ones we have are because his friend Sheridan, also a clergyman, said, "Here, let me have those. I'll preach them if you don't want to." So they're kind of minor part of his production.
Yeah. The eating of babies, would it not have been the belief of any educated person at that time that there was vast overpopulation and eating of babies actually would have been part of the belief system?
Well, there was an economic theory, the mercantile system, according to which people are the wealth of a nation. So the more people you have, the more production you will create. And Swift said that's true of every nation except this one, because it's being oppressed in such a way that we have the streets full of beggars and
he knew very well there was a lot of infanticide. Mothers who just could not possibly even nurse, let alone bring up a child. So there was a sense in which England was eating the Irish. So it's a metaphor, but more than a metaphor, I think. Yeah. Yes?
Final question. When you were doing your research in Dublin, how did scholars and ordinary people there react when you told them that you were writing this book?
One thing that surprised me, I kind of thought that academic establishment would come down on me like a ton of bricks, but in fact, a number of reviewers who are very distinguished 18th century scholars have obviously been waiting for 20 years for somebody to call out Irvin Ehrenpreis. Because, not to, you know, demean my former colleague, but he not only doesn't tell you things that he should tell you, he could say, I'm not sure this happened, or here's why I'm skeptical about it, but he just doesn't mention things that he chooses to think they wouldn't be relevant. But he also had an incredibly reductive Freudian theory of behavior formed in the 40s and 50s, with like the masochism of Vanessa. So Swift is always looking for a father figure. Swift had an uncle who was his guardian because his, at least, legal father had died. Swift hated the guy. He always called him an old rascal. He said he gave me the education of a dog. But Ehrenpreis says, this loving uncle gave him the hospitality of selfless generosity. You know, because one more thing. He says, Swift was brought up to think that his body was foul and evil and that he was a vessel of corruption. We know nothing about how he's brought up. We know zero about his upbringing, except it was a very moderate Anglican family that did not have those Calvinistical views, but Ehrenpreis needed them. So you read Ehrenpreis and you think, he must have found the documents somewhere, but he was making it up. So in short, people were waiting for someone to come along and do the job right. Because it's only if you immerse yourself in all the documents that you're sure what you know and you don't know. They knew it smelled bad, but they didn't do it. Themselves.
Okay.
Thank you.